a very nice village, but it's a bit scattered. It's a bit scattered. Awfully scattered. It's a scattered community.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this somewhat impromptu stream. It is Sunday, and I'm back a little bit earlier than I usually am. It's been a very busy period, friends. In fact, ever since I handed in the manuscript of the Prophets of Doom earlier this year, which was now back in February, I've had a very busy year. Not only with work things, but with non-work things. And it's been, you know, it's been a struggle just to keep everything going, to be honest. I've been pulled this way and that. And the past couple of weeks especially, I've had some work-related things that I've had to attend to, but also some family things as well. And all of that is taxing on one's time. And it's been, it's been quite difficult to get everything together. And I'm quite tired. It's coming up to 6 p.m. here on Sunday evening. And, you know, such has been my busyness that I haven't even been able to keep up with my obsessive watching of various streams on the Israel-Hamas conflict and, you know, haven't really been able to keep up with events as closely as I would like. I've got a huge backlog of shows I've not listened to from my various favorite content creators. But rather than go to sleep, I've just had a cigar, Juan Lopez Seleccione number 2, if you're interested. I did actually, about a week, maybe even 2 weeks ago, I went through my humidors and filmed all my various cigars. And yes, once again, testament to how busy I am, I have not yet been able to email myself for the video that I took and stick some stick some narration over it, because that was going to be a little video for the cigar fans among you. But I've yet to have the opportunity to do this. And rather than go to sleep, which is what I really want to do, I want to sort of just go to bed and hide under the duvet covers and sleep for the next 20 hours. I thought I'd force myself to do something of value. And hence, this stream is occurring. Just before we get going, I'll remind everybody that... I wouldn't usually sleep at 6 p.m. I'm just feeling tired. And, you know, I'm kind of forcing myself to stay awake by doing this stream. Just before we get going, we do have my Christmas sale, which is ongoing. I will play the advert during which I will sip some Coca-Cola Zero. So let's... 25% off all courses at the academic agency right now.
Place your foot on the base and pull the handle backward. Press the on-off button to switch the machine on.
And unlike many countries in the West, including Britain, Africa is not saddled with debt. The British debt is 87% of British GDP. The African debt is only 9% of their GDP. All but two countries in Africa pay off their debt within 1 year. So the debt is already there, and the growth is already beginning. Even now, Africa is the continent in the world with the fastest economic growth.
All right. So one of the things that I did earlier on, because during this ongoing period of busyness, every couple of days I return to thinking about writing the Boomer Truth Regime, my, you know, the third part in my trilogy. And I've got mountains of books here, mountains of books. I had reason to, so if you can imagine, I've got my library in my in the lodge, which many people have seen, but I also have a library in you know, where I live back home. There's a kind of study. I've got a study there where there's another kind of bookcase. And then long time listeners will remember that the cigar streams used to come from the garage. Anybody remember those days where I'd stream from the garage? And down in the garage, I have yet another library, a third library, which is actually the largest library. There's so many books down there. And I basically, I needed to get some old, I want to do this video on the history of sugar. And in order to make that video, I needed a book by Fernand Braudel called The Structures of Everyday Life, which is part of a series of books he did called Capitalism and Civilization. But while I was down there earlier on, raiding those shelves and effectively transferring them to the lodge where I'm, you know, where I do my most of my work these days, I picked up lots of books, and I'll show you a number of the books I picked up here. Basically, because these are books that, for one reason or another, I think I think that they may be relevant for Boomer Truth Regime, a book which I'm struggling to find the. I mean, I know what the central thesis is, but I'm struggling to find a kind of moment where it something clicks, right? When you're writing a book, something has to click. And I remember the exact moment writing Prophets of Doom where it clicked for me, right? And I'll tell you exactly when it was. It was when I was researching the history of cyclical histories, and it almost came as a kind of eureka. Oh, Christian history is linear. Linear history comes from the Bible. Huh. And it was then that I from that moment to finishing the book was about 2 months. Okay. And I don't know, maybe people who were watching at the time will remember me having this same struggling through. I had all the material. I kind of knew what the book was about, but something wasn't clicking. Once I had that, I was kind of good to go, right? But until I saw that, I couldn't write the book for whatever reason, okay? There was something missing. There was something that, and I'm in a similar situation now with Boomer Truth Regime, where I've got a really good idea of the sort of things I want to discuss and what the central ideas are, but there's something missing, right? There's something that hasn't clicked, and I don't even know what it is. But when I see it, I'll know it. Does that make sense? So I'm kind of muddling through at the moment. I'm muddling through, and I'll just show you some of the books that I picked up from the garage. There's Alan Bloom's American Closing of the American Mind. Can you all see that? Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind. Various books by Theodore Dalrymple. Some Hitchens books. Peter Osborne's The Triumph of the Political Class and the Rise of Political Lying. Modern Times by Paul Johnson, which I actually consider, maybe controversially, maybe not, that I consider Paul Johnson to be a Boomer Truth writer, right? Boomer Truth writer. By the way, am I sounding all right? Last time I did a solo stream, I was coming through like I was kind of there was something wrong with my mic that day, but I feel like okay, good. I feel that Paul Johnson is a Boomer Truth writer, and that the kings of Boomer Truth, if you want, are exactly people like Paul Johnson who sit in the center right. Okay. They sit in the center right. So I believe that Paul Johnson is a Boomer Truth writer. I also believe that Alan Bloom, even though he's known as a conservative and so on, Alan Bloom has got Boomer Truth levels as well. So, in fact, there's hidden Boomer Truth in all of these books. Even Peter Hitchens has got a bit of it, right? But anyway, there's something I'm looking for, and I don't know what. Still haven't found what I'm looking for. Maybe the whole book should just be analysis of Bono. Maybe the whole book should just be about Bono. But anyway, there's Groupthink by Christopher Booker, Kagan's Paradise and Power, which is the neocon manual, The Retreat of Western Liberalism, Putnam's Bowling Alone, an old classic, Douglas Murray's Madness of Crowds, which is ostensibly a book about woke. There's Roger Scruton's Where We Are, which was the last book he wrote before he died, or one of the last books he wrote. Runciman's How Democracy Ends, kind of a shit-lib book, really, worrying about Trump. But, you know, you understand there's a reason why all of these books are here. Arthur Lovejoy's The Great Chain of Being, which ultimately underpins my Trumpton ideas, my ideas about Trumpton. And it's a strong, if you go back and watch the original Boomer Truth videos, the idea of The Great Chain of Being is kind of vaguely in the background as a constant contrast to the Boomer Truth regime. So I thought that Great Chain of Being may be of interest. Patrick Deneen's Why Liberalism Failed. Clive James, who's one of my favorite writers for style. I remember loving the book Cultural Amnesia. I mean, Clive James is a liberal, right? He's a liberal, but I still kind of, you know, he was a big influence on me. His Clive James on television. There's going to be various moments where I need to refer to like stuff that happened on TV in Boomer Truth Regime. And there's a good chance Clive James reviewed it at some point. So that's why I've got that there. Jihad versus McWorld, we did a stream on that, if you recall. Then I've got a number of books by John Gray, who is going to provide the materials for what I'm about to read here. I've got a book, various books by him, Soul of the Marionette, Black Mass, Straw Dogs. You know, he's got tons of them. Frank Frudi's How Fear Works. But the book here I've got, which I'm going to be reading from, is False Dawn by John Gray. I'll speak more about him in a second. And then a pile of books by Fernand Braudel, who is a ostensibly Marxist, not Marxist really, a null school. They call it the null school of materialist, kind of materialist historiography. But he has always been a very interesting historian for me. I've written about him before in several of my other books. And this book here, The Structures of Everyday Life, has got the material about sugar that I want to read. In fact, it's got material about wheat, about various grains, about pepper, about salt. Maybe I'll do it all. Maybe I'll just read I'll do a series of videos from Braudel. Braudel is interesting. I'll just say, before we get into the Thatcher stuff, which I want to get into, people are laughing. You won't believe the impact of pepper and salt and sugar on what he calls the structures of everyday life. People aren't happy about the EA Gold background, so I can have that. Have the Old Woman's Hour one if you want. We can have Carlyle. We can have Blair. I mean, which one do you want? Let's just have the black one, shall we? All right. Braudel is kind of interesting because, in a way, he's the opposite of elite theory. you know, remember Burnham on Pareto. The history is the history of elites. The story is the story of elites. History is the graveyard of aristocracies, all of that stuff. Whereas Brodel, he looks at history in completely the other way. He says that the kings and the queens and the rulers are the kind of froth and ephemera. If you can imagine a cup of coffee, right, with some cream on top of it, right, all of the people are the coffee, and the elites in Brodel's view are just the cream. And in Brodel's conception of history, nothing really changes until things change for the coffee. That's a weird analogy, I know, but yeah. Basically, his point is that for long stretches of history, regardless of who the ruling class are, for the average peasant, nothing really changes, right? If you're a farmer in, 1400, and you compare the life of the farmer in 1400 to 1500 to 1600 to 1700, his point is that basically for that dude, nothing really changed. I mean, you can have Cromwell as the leader. You can have this king or that king as the leader. But basically, it's still basically just a kind of subsistence farmer. Your tools are the same. The rhythms of your life are the same. The market hasn't changed that much, et cetera, et cetera. This is Brodel. I mean, I'm not saying I agree with him. I'm saying that this is Brodel's basic approach to history. And what he does in this book, in this The Structures of Everyday Life, Civilization and Capitalism book, is he shows the impact of the introduction of various different things to the structures of everyday life. Like the one of the chapters I always remember from that book is he looks at how normal people were affected by the introduction of the knife and the fork and the plate, right? The metal fork and what was life like before you had a metal knife and fork? Something we'd never think about, right? Nobody would ever think about this sort of question. Well, in Brodel's view, the introduction of this thing is kind of transformative. This is one of the reasons why I want to kind of go over some of that material, because the impact of various grains and sugar and salt and pepper, believe it or not, especially pepper, there was a pepper craze at one point in Europe, affected life in what Brodel calls the longue durée, right, which is a fancy French way of just saying the kind of history viewed through the kind of telescope of long history, right? Diachronic history. And his point is that, like, the introduction of all of those things in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries changed life for the average man. And more importantly, the structures, the enduring structures of everyday life, more than the preceding 1,000 years, right? So, anyway, this is topic for another day. But that is how this stream, or the idea that I had for doing this stream, came about. Because, after I picked up all these books and I got them out of the car, lugged them back into the lodge and stuck them all on the table, I then started randomly picking some up and flicking through them. And I needed something to read while I smoked my Juan Lopez Seleccione number 2. And I happened to pick up False Dawn by John Gray. And I started reading his chapter, Engineering Free Markets, which my first excerpt is from here. I've got a number of excerpts about Thatcher that I want to read. And the reason that John Gray is interesting to me is because he, in the 1980s, he was a free market guy. he was a kind of libertarian or new right libertarian in the 80s. And then in the 90s, he decisively turned against liberalism and libertarianism and came to see the whole project as a kind of utopian, a dangerous utopian fantasy. Okay. Now John Gray is of interest because, I mean, he is hard to work out, right? He is ostensibly a man of the left, I think, right? I think he's a leftist, but he is a post-liberal in interesting ways. And one of the reasons he's of real interest, I think, is because he arrived at what we would recognize as post-liberal positions back in the 90s, back when Thatcher was still alive, even. And in fact, this essay here, I think, was written in, when was this written, this particular bit? 1998, right? So this part I'm about to read to you was written in 1998. Now, if I was to, this is going to sound a bit unusual, right? James Tyler says, always somebody else's opinion. You do have an opinion of your own, don't you? Well, let me tell you something, James Tyler. I will explain why I look at other people's opinions and don't just come up with my own, don't just kind of espouse. I mean, I've got lots of takes and lots of opinions, right? But there's a value in doing research and seeing what other people have said in order to try to arrive at your own views of things, to try to consider different opinions and different possibilities. This is what scholars do. They have a look at other things that have happened, other things that have been said, and consider a range of views in the field. And then, once informed with the full map of the different opinions that are out there, you can then start to say, well, who is right? Who is wrong? Who got what right? Who got what wrong? Who predicted things correctly? Who predicted things wrongly? Do you understand the value of doing that, James Taylor? Or are you a fucking retard, mate? I'll give you 5 seconds to answer and then I'll ban you. Yeah, because otherwise it's just a bunch of fucking monkeys on typewriters, on keyboards, spouting off ignorant views of things they know nothing about. Of course, how do you find out anything about anything? You moron. Whatever the truth is the truth, right? And the odds of you, James Taylor, whatever your name is, or me, just kind of like somehow arriving at all of the correct opinions without researching them is stupid. It's just stupid. It is the view of a moron. Okay? Do you understand that? Press 1 in the chat if you think that comment by James Taylor was a moronic comment, and press 2 if you agree with him. And I will ban all of the twos because I don't want you here. You can just go and watch Tim Pool, who doesn't read anything and reacts to every bit of news as if there's going to be a new civil war, or, you know, he just kind of goes with the emotion of it. And you can just have emotional responses to the latest thing. That's not what this channel is about. That's not what I'm about. That's not what scholarship is about. That's not what we're doing here. So maybe trundle off and watch someone who doesn't do any reading, doesn't consider anyone else's opinions, and just spouts off the whatever comes into their heads. How about that? Right. I'm now going to do a review of who pressed 1 and who pressed 2, and all of the twos will be banned. Okay? I don't want you watching this channel or this stream if you believe that it's a waste of time to consider what other people who may have been around for longer, may have lived through events that you didn't live through, may have have had access to things that you didn't have access to, may have understandings of things or studied things that you haven't. I mean, imagine what kind of hubristic, nonsensical view it is that you never have to read anything. It's just fucking moronic, isn't it? Well, I mean, what school is this? I read it on 4chan once. So, I'm going to have a look at who said to, and you're going to be banned, and you're going to be out of here. 10 bound brain says 2-2, banned. Pads 1982 said 2, banned. Let's see who else said it. Okay, lots of ones. Lots of ones. Lots of ones. Who's? I want the two. Where's James Taylor? Where are you? Sneak in. I'll find you. We'll have to wait. Now, you see, the stream is delayed and everybody has to wait because you made a stupid comment. So everybody has to wait. The 500 people watching this and the hundreds of more people who watch it on the replay now have to wait for me to find you. Don't they? So you don't think about what you say, do you? Bye, James. Banned forever. Banned. Okay? I don't give a shit what anybody else thinks about what I just did. I will run this channel the way I see fit. If you want to just have uninformed, right? If you want to have uninformed people spouting off takes, Twitter is just there. And all day, every day, idiots spout off about things they don't know about. All right? Okay. Now, why is it important for me to read this bit by John Gray about Thatcher? It's because Thatcher, everybody has this idea of what Thatcher did and her role in kind of British history. But I think that the way Gray critiques Thatcher touches on a lot of things that we have talked about on this channel. And it also touches on a lot of things that are typically attributed, I think, to a certain Tony Blair. But actually, it was Thatcher who may have done a lot of it. So I will try to keep my comments to a minimum while we read through this by John Gray. It's only a few pages. And then if we've got time, we will, if we have time, there are a number of other essays by him on Thatcher, shorter ones, in this collection I've got called Gray's Anatomy, which we may have a look at as well. Okay. Okay. Based Future said two, banned. I don't care if you're a channel member, mate. If you wanted to, I mean, I don't care if you pay £20 a month. If you're gonna have that view, you don't belong here. As simple as that. I've never wanted the audience of millions. I want the audience of people who are interested in what we're doing here. And if you're not interested, skedaddle. End of. Oh, I was just messing around. Well, don't fucking mess around. You know I don't like jokes. So why do you do it? Now you're banned. End of. Oh, no. I don't want DMs afterwards. I don't want, oh, you know, why do you have to be like this, etc.? You know what I'm like. So why do you do it? Right. Now. Okay. The Thatcherite experiment. Thatcher's attempt to resurrect the free market in late 20th century Britain is instructive not only for its strategies and successes, but for the manner and causes of its downfall. In one respect, Thatcherite policy was an attempt to impose a much-needed modernization on the British economy. In another, it tried to reshape British institutions along the lines of an irrecoverable past. These two aspects of Thatcherite policy are intimately, even inseparably linked. The electoral coalition which Thatcher mobilized behind her key policies, reducing trade union power, removing council houses from municipal ownership, and lowering direct taxes, enabled her to win three successive elections, all true. Her demolition of Britain's post-war consensus triggered a far-reaching transformation in the Labour Party, aka the coming of New Labour, Tony Blair, etc., that resulted in its return to power after a landslide victory in May 1997. Thatcherism did not begin as a political project in which ideology was central. The Labour government of James Callaghan had already begun dismantling British corporatism when, in response to the imperatives imposed upon it by the International Monetary Fund in the autumn of 1976, it announced that the pursuit of full employment through Keynesian policies of economic management was no longer feasible. But it could not do more than inaugurate that break with Britain's post-war settlement. It could not reform British industrial relations. Thatcherism began as a local response to a British problem. In its initial policy agenda, nothing was more important than trade union reform. Margaret Thatcher understood that British corporatism, the triangular coordination of economic policy by government, employers, and trade unions, had become an engine of industrial conflict and strife over the distribution of the national income rather than an instrument of wealth creation or a guarantor of social cohesion. For much of the 1980s, Thatcherism was a gloss on this perception. The early years of the Thatcher era were not informed by any coherent political doctrine. Indeed, the very idea of Thatcherism as an ideology may have been invented by the left. A handful of perceptive Marxists, notably Martin Jakes, editor of the pioneering journal Marxism Today, were among those who first grasped that Thatcher's governments marked an irreversible break with post-war British social democracy. Yet, by the time Thatcher was toppled, a callow new right ideology had become pervasive in her government's thinking, evident in such fateful policies as the poll tax. A circle of folly and hubris had closed around Thatcher and her advisers. Within that circle, she was sheltered from public and business alarm that her policies, not only on the poll tax, but more significantly on Britain's relations with the European Union, were driven by ideology rather than practical necessity. The government of John Major, which followed in 1990, did not temper her policies. They simply applied more mechanically. Britain's railway network was broken up into 40 privatized companies, a move that was popular with no one, apart from a few rentiers of railway rolling stock. It merely compounded the electoral difficulties of Major's last government. The project of re-engineering the free market was not then set back when Thatcher was toppled from power. It was merely given a second long wind. Britain was thus subjected to free market policies for nearly two decades. And what of the touchstones of New Right obloquy? The size of the British state did not shrink. It preempted as much of the nation's economic resources as it had in the 1970s, far more than had the Labour government of 1945. Levels of tax for most families were higher at the end of the Thatcherite period than they had been at its start. In some areas, such as the reduction of union power, Thatcherite policy, helped by major changes in the real economy, achieved its objectives, but its overall result was to set in place the conditions for its political defeat. Thatcherite policies eroded the class culture on which the almost unbroken dominance of the Conservative Party on British political life for over a century depended. A set of policies which put into place, a set of policies which put into the melting pot a whole range of industries, neighbourhoods and professions could not renew the electoral coalition which made it politically possible in the first place. Transformations which Thatcherite policies imposed on British institutions always risked engulfing its political vehicle, the Conservative Party. The political parties that impose revolutionary changes on nearly every aspect of life, of social and economic life, cannot escape their consequences for themselves. The Conservative Party has been in decline since the 1950s. And remember, he's writing in 1998. That process of decline quickened dramatically during its period of unchallenged power in the 1980s, with old members dying off and not being replaced by new recruits. It is a telling postscript to the glory years of Thatcherite supremacy that the average age of the Conservative Party membership when it suffered its catastrophic defeat in May of 1997 was somewhere in the mid-60s. Despite Thatcher's own rigidly hostile attitude to constitutional reform, the institutions of the British state could not escape deep changes arising as unintended side effects of Thatcherite policies. And this is where I think this analysis gets very, very interesting indeed, because this is where there's a kind of, to use poetic language, a caesura or turn in what I think Gray is saying here, which I think is really interesting. Chief among those side effects was a sweeping centralization of power in the institutions of national government. As A.V. Dicey observed of the original 19th century experiment in laissez-faire, sincere believers in laissez-faire found that for the attainment of their ends, the improvement and strengthening of governmental machinery was absolutely necessary. This was not a peculiarly British aberration. It was the local expression of a universal paradox. In the normal course of things, markets become embedded in social life. They are circumscribed in their workings and tacit understandings. Among these intermediary institutions, trade unions and professional associations have long been central in standing between individuals and market forces. Constructing a free market demands that these social institutions be weakened or destroyed. They must be defeated as particular producer interests that stand in the way of the universal consumer. Only a strong centralized state can wage war on such powerful intermediary institutions. So if you understand what he's saying here, right, he's saying that in order for free market liberalization to occur, you actually need to standardize and centralize all the institutions, i.e. making it less local and more national. Less local, more national. Okay, so he's talking about Thatcher as an instrument of government centralization and a concentration of power in London. Okay, very interesting insight by Gray here, which I think is true. The centralization of the British state in the Thatcherite period was not an error of policy that might have been avoided. It was an integral part of engineering the free market. So according to Gray, it's not actually possible to do what Thatcher wanted to do. It's not like this was an option. You basically have to do this if you're going to make your society function along quote-unquote market principles, okay? The British Constitution, which Thatcher inherited in 1979, was soon deformed beyond recognition. The barriers between the institutions of the British state, the government and the Conservative Party that were embodied in the tacit understandings and unwritten conventions of the pre-Thatcher Constitution were blurred or weakened. Once taken for granted, the political neutrality of the civil service began to seem doubtful. The institutions of the Quango state were colonized by Tory placemen and women. Intermediary bodies that were once autonomous institutions became the property of a caste of Tory nomenclatorists. That's a long word. The relationship of trust between rulers and ruled that was an indispensable condition of legitimacy in an unwritten constitution became a mere memory. The upshot was a radically unbalanced constitution that could not outlast a conservative electoral defeat. Thatcherite policies affected many significant changes in British society and institutions, some of them irreversible. Of these, the many privatizations may not turn out to have the deepest or the most lasting importance. The first privatization was not even initiated by the Tories. It was implemented by Labour when Dennis Healey announced the selling off of part of the state share in the ownership of British Petroleum, that's BP. In fact, privatisation figured only slightly in early Thatcherism. It did not appear at all in the 1979 election manifesto and first featured in a Tory administration in 1982, when the lack of funds needed for the modernisation of the British telecommunications industry forced the government to consider what was then a revolutionary step, the privatisation of a major public utility, that is BT, of course, as you all know. The seminal privatisation was driven not by doctrine, but by the logic of events. An industry that needed urgent injections of capital that it knew it could not get from the public, right? So basically, BT needed money, and they couldn't raise this from tax, so they needed to privatize it in order to inject the capital. And he's saying this logic is inevitable, right? Treasury-controlled funds had no option but to go to the capital markets for them. To do that, of course, James Taylor, who was banned earlier on, and the other two wankers who I banned, they knew all this already. They don't need to read this because they somehow just knew it innately. They just knew that already, didn't you guys? Fucking twats. Anyway, let's continue. So, Treasury-controlled funds had no option but to go to the capital markets for the funds. To do that, it needed to be privatized. In one of the ironies that abound during this period, the privatization of British Telecom was so successful that in the event, it was able to fund its technological modernization from its own resources. Privatization appeared for the first time in a Tory election manifesto in 1983. The irony is that I am also probably the most opinionated person in the entire sphere, with the most original takes and the widest, the biggest hit rate and the widest proliferation of original takes. So I just don't understand why these people want to come into my chat and have a go at me during the stream where I'm reading this interesting material. I will not tolerate it. I won't tolerate it at all. I'll just turn the chat off if that's what it comes to. All right? Okay, so let me continue. To do that, it needed to be privatized. In one of the ironies that abound during this period, the privatization of British Telecom, that's BT, was so successful that in the event it was able to fund its technological modernization from its own resources. Privatization appeared for the first time in a Tory election manifesto in 1983. The list of state assets privatized during the following years of the neoliberal policy is long and substantial. In 1979, government institutions owned much or all of, and so this is what the government owned in 1979. It's a big list, okay? Coal, steel, gas, electricity, water, railways, airlines, telecommunications, nuclear power, and shipbuilding, and had a significant stake in oil, banking, shipping, and roll haulage. Okay, so that's a huge chunk of the economy that was essentially controlled by the British state. Okay, by 1997, nearly all of this was in private hands, probably in foreign hands too. In addition, well over a million former tenants in municipal housing owned their own homes. That was essentially Thatcher selling off the council housing to, you know, the, what was it called, that scheme? You could buy your own council house. So that's what she did. Right to buy, exactly. Right to buy. Running alongside this privatization of state assets, there was comprehensive nationalization of local government. Give me one second here. Running alongside this privatization of state assets, there was a comprehensive nationalization of local government and intermediary institutions. The National Health Service, the schools, former polytechnics and universities, prisons, the administration of justice, and the authorities regulating the police forces were all reorganized. They were removed from the control of democratically elected local authorities and placed under the control of unelected quangos and next steps agencies, which were unaccountable, if at all, only to central government. Now, why does this sound familiar? Why does this sound so familiar? The removal of democratically elected local authorities and the placement of unelected quangos and next step agencies, you know, accountable only to central government. This happened under Thatcher, although we think of it typically as a Blair move, right? But actually, it was a Thatcher move. This is what this is kind of it's managerialism as we recognize it. In other words, by 1995, such quangos employed more people and spent more money than did the local government. Finally, market mechanisms, compulsory competitive tendering, performance-related and profit-related pay, and similar devices were injected into all public services. And I guess this reminds me, by the way, of the person who I think is closest to the politics of John Gray, right? Because John Gray is very difficult to place. Like, where's he coming from? And I would say the person who I think is closest to him is probably Adam Curtis. And Adam Curtis covers some of this material that we're going over now, the injection of market mechanisms into public services, for example, this kind of this managerialism essentially was a hallmark of Thatcherism and then a later hallmark of Blairism, as we know. Okay. Where's that? I'm feeling bad for banning that guy. I'll unban that guy. I got carried away. Let me unban that guy. What's his name? Based. What's that guy's name? based feature, I'll unban him. It's Christmas time. I'm feeling charitable. I'm feeling remorse for some reason, so I'll unban him. Although I can't find him now. I can't find his name. Is it that guy? I can't find him now. See, it's basically impossible to find you. Anyway, if you send me the link to your channel, I'll find a way to unban you. All right. I can't find him. yeah, soft. Exactly. Soft. Going soft. I think I've got him there. Is that him? I think that's him there. Yeah, if he's still around, he can try to post. If not, oh, there he is. I've got him. There he is. Okay. He's back. All right. Let's carry on. I think Adam Curtis, who's also really difficult to place, like, I don't know what Adam Curtis's politics are really, but he makes these kind of interesting critiques. Him and John Gray, I would be unsurprised if Adam Curtis either knows John Gray or reads John Gray. They seem like they come from a similar place. Okay. Okay. Let's carry on. Wishy-washy. I mean, that's one way of putting it, Fred Bloggs. I would say they're ambivalent. It's like they've come to a lot of post-liberal and base conclusions, but they don't have courage to, like, go based, if that makes any sense. That's my kind of a liberal. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to. Yeah, exactly. And I would say that description, Adam Curtis does good work, but he misses the big picture sometimes. I would say that is also true of John Gray in general, right? But anyway, let's continue. The Thatcherite nationalisation of Britain paralleled the changes imposed on the labour market, reducing trade union power and approaching a more individualist labour market were among the few unequivocally clear objectives of the first Thatcher government. In combination with a monetarist commitment to price stability achieved at any social or economic cost, they sealed the fate of the post-war settlement in Britain. The Keynesian Beveridgian consensus not only assumed full employment as the most indispensable precondition of a sustainable welfare state, it also imposed an overriding obligation on national government to promote it. The explicit abandonment under Thatcher of government responsibility for full employment marked not only a change in economic doctrine from Keynes to Milton Friedman, it affected a fundamental shift in understanding the functions of the state. In this shift, the decisive text was not F.A. Hayek's Constitution of Liberty or any other crib for neoliberal ideologues, but Stepping Stones by John Hoskins, a guide to dealing with trade union power and creating a free market in labour. This document was never published. According to the Thatcherite understanding of the role of the state, its task was to supply a framework of rules and regulations within which the free market, including crucially the labour market, would be self-regulating. In this vision, the role of trade unions as an intermediary, as intermediary institutions standing between the workers and the market, had to be altered and weakened. Employment law was reshaped. The contemporary model that informed these changes throughout was the American labour market, with its high levels of mobility, downwards flexibility of wages, and low costs for employers. Interesting, eh? Interesting. Partly as a result of these policies, there was an explosive increase in part-time and contract work. The bourgeois institution of the career or vocation ceased to be valuable as an option for increasing numbers of workers. many low-skill workers earned less than the minimum needed to support a family. The diseases of poverty, such as TB, rickets, and others, returned. The former middle classes were exhorted to become portfolio persons, attached to no particular company or institution. As a survey concluded in 1996, the traditional career has ended and has become just a memory. At the same time, entitlements to welfare benefits were restricted across the board, with unemployment benefits such as Job Seekers Allowance of 1996 designed specifically to compel recipients to accept work at market-driven rates. It may not be fanciful to hear an echo of the poor law reforms of the 1830s. That is, the poor law reforms of the 1830s, and I have a whole book on those reforms here somewhere. Maybe they're in my, maybe they're at home, but I've got a whole book on those poor law reforms, a kind of economic history of them, which is interesting in and of itself. Anyway, the the innermost contradiction of the free market is that it works to weaken the traditional social institutions on which it has depended in the past. The family is the key example. The fragility and decline of the traditional family increased throughout the Thatcherite period. The proportion of women aged 18 to 49 who were married fell from 74% in 1979 to 61% in 1991, while the proportion cohabiting increased from 11% to 22% during the same period. Births outside marriage more than doubled during the 1980s. One-parent families increased from 12% in 1979 to 21% in 1992, with the biggest single increase being in single mothers who had never been married. Now, why is this important? Right? Why is this important? It is because if you read Hoover Institution stuff or stuff from the American New Right or stuff from the IEA and all these sorts of places, they will argue that these phenomena, declining marriage rates, single parent mothers, are all the effects of the welfare state, right? Social welfare or socialism, and these are the causes. Whereas what John Gray is saying is that actually these are the effects of neoliberal quote unquote reforms or the revolution, undertaken by Thatcher. By 1991, there was one divorce for every two marriages in Britain, the highest divorce rate of any EU country and comparable only with that in the United States. Is it coincidental that no EU country apart from Britain has imposed American-style deregulation on its labour market? In those British cities in which Thatcherite policies of labour market deregulation were most successful in lowering the rates of unemployment, rates of divorce and family breakdown were correspondingly the highest. Right. So what he's saying is that where the Thatcherite policy basically decreased unemployment, it increased divorce, family breakdown. OK, so John Gray here is drawing a direct line between free market policies that are basically pushing women into the workplace and breaking apart the family unit with these other things that are typically blamed on the left, right? The breakdown of the family is typically blamed on the left. And what Gray is doing is showing that they were actually the effect of Thatcher's policies. Still more striking. I mean, base feature is lucky because it's Christmas time and I'm feeling sentimental. I'm sentimental. Ultimately, I'm a someone with an unlimited capacity for empathy. Anyway, let's continue. Still more striking was the growth of an underclass. The percentage of British, that is non-pensioner households, that are wholly workless, that is, none of the whose members is active in the productive economy, increased from 6.5% in 1975 to 16.4% in 1985 and 19.1% in 1994. Right, so basically the people on welfare, the social underclass, the people who are discussed in those books by Theodore Dalrymple, when he, all those books he has about on the social underclass, that basically, that phenomena happened under the Tories, right? From 6.5% in 1975 to 16.4% a decade later to 19.1% in 1994. I mean, that's basically, it basically quadrupled under the Tories. This increase continued, perhaps even accelerated, under the government of John Major. Between 1992 and 1997, there was a 15% increase in unemployed lone parents. To spell it out, in Britain today, around one in five households, not counting pensioners, contains not a single working person. I'll repeat that. To spell it out, in Britain today, that was in 1998, so just over 25 years ago, around one in five households, not counting pensioners, contains not a single working person. So that's about 20% of the whole population, working population, not in employment. This represents a magnitude of social exclusion unknown in any other European country, but long familiar in the United States. This, I mean, isn't it interesting, eh? Isn't it interesting? Anyway, let's carry on. This dramatic growth of an underclass occurred as a direct consequence of neoliberal welfare reforms, particularly as they affected housing. The selling off of council houses to their tenants is often praised as a Thatcherite success story. Certainly, it was electorally significant as a source of support for Thatcherism in the 1980s, though it may well have worked against the Conservatives in the 1990s. In social and economic terms, the decimation of municipal housing was one of the chief elements in the emergence of a neoliberal dependency culture. Spending on housing benefit during 1996-7 was estimated at over £11 billion. That was in money back then. This is 1.5% of Britain's gross domestic product and over 10 times the social cost of housing benefits in 1979 to 1980. I mean, that's a huge increase, and it happened under the Tories. Right? They weren't Labour policies, were they? That happened under the Tories, and it happened under Thatcher in particular. Public expenditure on social housing was replaced many times over by rent, rebates, and assistance with payment of mortgages. The price of privatizing municipal housing in Britain has been a colossal increase in welfare dependency. What is more significant in these developments is the difference between the British experience and that of other European countries that have not undergone a prolonged period of neoliberal public policy, and the striking similarities they exhibit with trends in the United States. Even in penal policy, there is a remarkable correlation. Britain's incarceration rate is far higher than any other EU country, though still much lower than that of the the United States, and it is rising fast. Between 1992 and 1995, Britain's prison population increased by nearly a third to over 50,000. This is something that Peter Hitchens has also talked about in his fantastic book, A Brief History of Crime, incidentally, if you're interested in that topic. Figures on rates of crime are harder to come by and notoriously tricky to interpret. Nevertheless, there can be no mistaking the overall trends. In 1970, right, that's back in the bad old socialist days of 1970, there were under 1.6 million serious crimes known to the police in England and Wales. In 1981, there were 2.8 million. At the end of 1990, the figure of recorded crime stood at 4.3 million. For 1992, the corresponding figure was 5.6 million. Moreover, the 1992 British Crime Survey suggested that the real figure was nearer to three times the official figure. Okay, now obviously some of that will be mitigated by population increase, but the population of Britain did not increase by the same as the increase in the rate of crime, if you have a look. I just know that because I look at population stats a lot. At the same time, state expenditure on law enforcement in Britain increased steadily. Between 1978 and 1979 and 1982-83, spending on the police forces increased by nearly a quarter in real terms. The number of police rose by nearly 10,000 to over 120,000 in Margaret Thatcher's first term in office. Holy shit. Oof. That's a huge increase. Such increases in the pay and numbers of police were not a feature of John Major's administrations. Overall, the trends were for crime of all kinds and forms of state expenditure on law enforcement to rise throughout the Thatcherite period, a trend paralleled in the New Zealand experiment. And if you're interested, friends, if any friends from New Zealand are here, he's got a chapter on New Zealand as well, and also a chapter on Mexico, which also had a neoliberal experiment that didn't go that well in the early 90s, as well as he's got a chapter on Russia under Boris Yeltsin as well. But yeah, the parallels with New Zealand are particularly interesting that he draws out. So this trend was paralleled in New Zealand and in Ronald Reagan's America. The recent sociological assessment offers a good summary of Thatcherism's consequences for crime and social order. This is a quotation from this assessment. As far as crime in general is concerned, the evidence suggests that both the predominant types of crime and the increased lawlessness of the last decade are best understood in terms of the long-term changes in British society that have been taking place for almost 20 years. The progressive weakening of the traditional social bonds of family and community and the final transformation of the traditional function of state primary and secondary schools from one of pedagogically orientated social control to one of competitively and socially divisive oriented acquisition of knowledge and skills. The role of the Victorian board school, which persisted as a model for primary education well into the present century, has been forgotten. It is the virtual disappearance of a range of auxiliary agents of social control, from park keepers to bus conductors and school attendance officers, which has left the police overexposed and inadequately resourced to deal with the problem of crime. Increasing resort to carceral solutions for social problems is equally lacking in effect, but ruinously expensive. Crime of the kind that afflicts Britain and much of the post-industrial world runs an altogether deeper malaise. And this is also something that Peter Hitchens talks about in the aforementioned book. Okay, so I'm hoping you're seeing why this is interesting, interesting from our perspective. Because basically the weakening of the social bonds that Thomas Carlyle was talking about were still kind of, those social bonds were still kind of limping on in retarded form, even as late as the 1970s, right? I mean, even my mother, who, you know, grew up in Wales in the 50s and 60s, remembers this. She remembers what life was like, and she tells me about, you know, the time she was ostracized for taking an apple from the churchyard and nobody talked to her for a year and stuff like that. But all of these kind of pillars of the community, like the park keeper or the, you know, the old woman who works in the post office or something, that used to kind of use like soft social power to police what was going on in the community and to pick up on transgressions and things. Basically, what Gray is saying is that Thatcher ultimately destroyed the last vestiges of all of that, which is a huge, huge social transformation. And unfortunately for us, for me and for all of you, we never got to experience this. You know, as a child of Thatcher, I never knew that world. I knew like the kind of memory of that world, right? I never actually got to live in it. Basically, anyone who's here younger than me, unless you grew up in a particularly secluded place or you're an expat or something like that, which may have some vestige of that old way of doing things, most of us have never known it. We can only read about it. We were denied this. I will continue. The connection between, I mean, somebody in the chat says this is a bunch of empty rhetoric. I don't think it is a bunch of empty rhetoric. How did Britain manage to maintain lower levels of crime with a police force of only 10,000, which then had to be increased to 120,000 under Thatcher? How was it able to maintain such low crime levels? You can only do that with high trust communities and societies. And those high trust communities, those local communities, don't run themselves. They need all of those little people, the bus conductors and the zookeeper and the shopkeeper and the, you know, the lollipop man and all these sorts of people. They were the ones who basically did. It's not empty rhetoric, mate. I don't know why you think it's empty rhetoric, but it's not. And the figures speak for themselves. Everybody knows. In the 1950s, crime was nothing compared to the levels that we saw in the 80s and since. You know, James Cleverly was boasting the other day, you know, Suella Braverman, oh, we recruited another like 30,000 police officers. All right, I'll continue. The connection between free markets and quote-unquote law and order policies has never been inadvertent. The intermediary social institutions and the informal social controls of community life are weakened by market-driven economic change. The disciplinary functions of the state are strengthened. The end point of this development comes when the sanctions of the criminal law become the principal remaining support of social order. In the United States, this point may not be far off. And we see the scenes from the United States every day on Twitter. And he was talking in 1998 back then. So anyway, let's continue. The self-undermining effect of Thatcherism as a political project came from its unintended social consequences. An economic policy that speeds the disappearance of industries and neighborhoods encourages voters to question their loyalties. This was especially true in Britain, where electoral allegiances and class culture have always been closely and deeply connected. In accelerating the dissolution of the old class culture, Thatcherite policies weakened long-established party support. Initially, this worked to Thatcher's political advantage as long-standing Labour voters switched to the Tories. Over the longer run, as it corroded Tory support in the middle classes, it made Conservative rule impossible to sustain. Thatcherite policies also promoted a striking growth in economic inequality. According to the authoritative Rowntree report on income and wealth, inequality increased in Britain between 1977 and 1990, faster than in all but one other comparable country. After 1979, the lowest income groups ceased to benefit from economic growth. Since 1977, the proportion of the population with less than half the average income more than trebled. By 1984 to 1985, the richest fifth share of after-tax income, 43%, was higher than at any other time after the war. Now, although there's no problem with inequality per se, I do think that this feature of what people call neoliberalism also erodes the social fabric, because when it reaches its advanced and extreme state, which we see in a place like San Francisco, right, the gap between like the executive who works for Google and lives in a kind of state-gated community and his or her Z, right? The gap between that person's income and their semi-legal kind of third world migrant quasi-slave who washes their house for them, and possibly looks after their kids, is insane. And it's not good, because it leads to a very stratified low trust society like the one you see in California, right? And I remember during this exact period, Californication, anyone remember that album? Basically, as goes California, over time goes the rest of America. And what these policies are doing, have done in America and in California, is happening in this country as well. You are now getting the same effects in Britain. And as Europe has become more neoliberal, you're also starting to see things like that there as well. And in fact, in parts of Europe, they are facing problems the likes of which we've never seen. I'm talking about children homeless on the street, mothers sleeping on the pavement with a two-year-old or a three-year-old. That never used to happen in Europe. Never used to happen in this country. And it's starting to happen all over Europe as a consequence of these policies. Let's continue. I mean, all inclusives is saying lies. They're not lies. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen that with my own eyes, all inclusives. I've seen it with my own eyes, so I don't know why you're saying lies. Yeah, spamming chat and saying lies is going to lead to a ban, I'm afraid. That's going to lead to a ban, I'm afraid. Don't spam, please. Banned. Okay, I will continue. But anyway, that phenomena of children on the street, I've seen it myself. Though several measures of inequality have risen in many first world countries, the speed and magnitude of economic inequalities in Britain is far ahead of nearly all the others. Only in New Zealand, where neoliberal policies were even more radical and the egalitarian inheritance more pronounced, did inequality grow faster. In the general election of May 1997, the Conservative share of the popular vote was lower than it had been at any time since the Great Reform Act of 1832. The Conservative Party was shipwrecked by the Thatcherite revolution. The Tory debacle had many causes. Some lay in policy errors that might have been avoided, others in historical accident that need not have happened. The poll tax was a prime example of an avoidable error. Thatcher's stridently nationalistic rhetoric about the European Union in the period immediately before her downfall may not have augured any basic shift in policy on her part, but it alarmed pro-European opinion in her party and in the business world. The BSE crisis that haunted the dying administration of John Major was a consequence of misguided policies that would happen when it did by accident. As always in political life, luck played a role that was sometimes decisive. Thatcher very nearly came unstuck in the Westlands crisis, at which point the free market experiment might have ended in Britain. A major military setback in the Falklands War with Argentina could also have had destabilizing political repercussions. Like all politicians, Margaret Thatcher depended on her luck holding until 1990, when she was brought down by a Tory coup against her. It did. Thatcherism was granted another lease of life by John Major's surprise victory in the general election of 1992. By then, the electorate had come to accept that the performance of the economy was not a result of skillful management by government, but a byproduct of world markets. Until the 1980s, the governments in Britain sought to align the business cycle with the electoral cycle. They tried to manage the economy to their own advantage by stop-go policies. A major goal of the new right was to separate governments from economic fluctuations in the judgment of voters. They shaped a public culture in which governments could shift responsibility for the economy to world markets. The result of the 1992 election showed that the new right had succeeded in its strategy of decoupling the economy's performance from the voter perception of the competence of the government. But this victory was short-lived and paradoxical in its consequences. When Britain was driven out of the ERM in 1993, the link between the competence of the government and the performance of the economy was re-established in the perception of the voters. For the Conservatives, this recoupling was disastrous. Yet the split between economic performance and the competence of government produced by new right policy in the 1980s lingered on in voters' minds. The Conservatives got little credit for the economic boom of the mid-1990s. That's true. That was when, I believe, was it Nigel Lawson? No, Norman Lamont. I want to say Norman Lamont was Chancellor during that period. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? British public opinion takes a market economy for granted. If it was ever sympathetic to socialist projects of economic planning, it is so no longer. But it is also hostile to the sway of unfettered markets over the life of society. It wishes to see some goods, basic medical care, schooling, and protection from crime provided to all as a mark of citizenship. It regards the privatization of public utilities such as water with suspicion, and it resists the further marketization of public services such as the care of the elderly. It will not accept American labor mobility. 60% of British adults live within 5 miles of where they were born, a higher proportion than in the 19th century. Thatcherism has signally failed to alter these British attitudes. Deep-rooted values of fairness and mutual aid block the full reinstatement of free market in Britain. The public legitimacy of the free market has waned with the modernization of society that Thatcher's policies promoted. The beliefs and practices on which free markets would trade in mid-Victorian period were weak or absent in 1979, and weaker still when the Conservatives lost power in 1997. The free market worked to dissipate what remained of them. In Britain, as elsewhere, the social dislocations produced by the free market have evoked a powerful political revulsion that has partly thwarted its political ambitions. In its larger outlines, the economic restructuring which Thatcherite policies effected in Britain is not reversible by any subsequent government. It has not overcome Britain's long economic decline. Not save perhaps in one or two sectors, such as telecommunications and the entertainment industries, has it generated the enterprise culture of which its ideologues spoke and wrote. Yet precisely because of Britain's continuing economic weakness, its dependency on foreign investment and world capital markets, no government can now roll back the policies of privatization or act decisively through the tax system to remedy the increase in economic inequalities. History has imposed on the Labour government elected in May 1997 the task of promoting social democratic values at a time when the historic institutions and policies of social democracy have disappeared. As Europe's first post-social democratic administration, Tony Blair's government must strive to reconcile a deregulated market economy with social cohesion. I mean, did Tone achieve that? I don't think he did, to be honest. It must do so in an environment that has been marked indelibly by free market policies and by the irreversible advance of economic globalization during the long Thatcherite period. And he continues. So this next section is called The Undoing of Conservatism, right? The Undoing of Conservatism. Thatcherite economic policies strengthened and accelerated most of the social and economic forces that have subsequently resulted in the dissolution of traditional families and communities. They set British society on a forced march into late modernity. The role of Thatcherism as a modernizing project is rarely understood. The backward-looking character of market liberal ideology can be deceptive. Re-engineering the free market in late modern Britain dissolved the last remnants of the social order that had sustained it in the 19th century. This is something that Peter Hitchens talks about. It's also something, by the way, that Joseph Schumpeter talks about in his very good book on socialism and democracy, which I have here somewhere. He basically says that the only reason that liberalism worked in Britain is because effectively it piggybacked on the kind of remnants of the old social order that Carlyle was trying to save. So Schumpeter has this, he wrote that book in 1948, and he basically says that, like, basically Britain is living on the corpse of an old social order. And once that social order has gone, Britain will be fucked. That's what Schumpeter says, right? But anyway, this is John Gray saying something similar in 1998, right? Let's continue. Not only the traditional family, but the class culture of deference and respectability, which had been indispensable to the free market, have been largely swept away. And these are things that also my mother has talked about growing up in a little town in Wales in the 50s and the 60s. She'd tell you about the basic respect and the kind of hierarchy people had within the little town. You know, the respect you'd show the local school teacher, or, you know, the union boss, or, you know, the foreman, or, you know, the even like the butcher and the baker in town or whatever. There'd be a kind of basic level of respect that existed between the individuals in that town. so that it was a genuine community, which was high trust and had social cohesion. Okay, all of that is gone now. Right, all of that is gone, and I mean, when I was a kid in the '80s, the very last fag end of it was gone. Right, I mean, I told this story on Twitter the other day when I ran away once from school, from home. I ran away from home, and I made it to the top of our street, and an old woman was like, "What are you doing, dear? And I'll take you home." And basically, I was taken like immediately back home, and then I was in, you know, I told the story before, I was in real trouble because my dad got his electric saw out and said, "I'm gonna, if you do that again, I'll saw your legs off," which I've never forgotten, obviously. But the very fact that, you know, in that day and age, I could wander up to the end of the street and there was still somebody, basically, you'd think, "What's that boy doing there? He needs to be taken back home." And I mean, okay, maybe that would happen now, but I can't count on it. I just don't know if that would happen. And I reckon it only happened back then because that old woman was from this older world, right? And it was only like we were in the middle of it happening, right? So anyway, let me continue. Unperceived and never comprehended by Thatcherism's. I mean, I'd like to say that if I saw a little kid wandering on their own, I would do the same as that old lady. But of course, we live in such a low trust society now that other things would have crossed your mind. What if somebody thinks I'm trying to do something, other thoughts would intrude, right? Is what I'm saying. Because the society is that low trust now. I mean, there are many things. There are many things that you can point to. I remember when I was a kid, it was not uncommon, right? If somebody saw a kid misbehaving, let's say in the supermarket or in a queue, or, you know, you're out and about, it was not uncommon for another adult to step in and, you know, tell off that kid and bring them back into line, right? People wouldn't do that now. And I think if people did do it, the mother of the kid would be funny and you get a funny look, or they think it was inappropriate, or you're overstepping the line or something, right? So I'm talking about things like that. You know, that there was a whole, you know, and like I said, I never really experienced it properly. I had the fag end of it when I was little. Those things just don't happen now. They don't. And also as an adult, you don't always feel comfortable because you don't know what the reaction will be from the other person. You know, you don't know if you intervening to take that kid home would get you into trouble. Because the society is that low trust. Is, you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So, yeah, everybody is saying here their own experiences of this. You know, if you approach the child, you get into trouble. The mother would tell you off. You know, because we live in a low trust society now. Where, you know, it's atomized. It's there is no social cohesion. Everybody's just like on their phone in their own little bubble. In imposing a forced modernization on many aspects of life in Britain, Thatcherism made the projects of its chief political rivals obsolete. It marginalized one nation Toryism in the Conservative Party and the Social Democrats who broke away from the Labour Party in the 1980s. Neither had a clear sight of the scale of the changes that were afoot in Britain. In different ways, each depended on a class culture that Thatcherism was eroding. The root of these contending political projects was one of the New Right's signal successes in Britain. But in displacing these political tendencies from the political centre ground in Britain, Thatcherism created some of the conditions for its own demise. One of Thatcherism's many ironies was its relationship with the nation state. Neoliberal economic policies stripped the nation state of most of its leverage over national economic life, while Thatcherite public rhetoric clothed this denuded institution with an archaic veil of authority. The nation state was held to be supremely important. National culture was claimed to be vital to social order. Yet, neoliberal economic policies prized open the British economy to world markets as never before. A rhetoric of inexorable economic globalization was combined with the assertion of the unique authority and indispensable utility of a common national culture. Britain's relationship with the European Union was condemned as a fetter on its national sovereignty by Tory neoliberals who held that no national government could hope to buck world markets. Interesting. The sovereign nation state was glorified at just the historical moment when those who elevated it declared it to be economically redundant. Good point. In the mass media, Thatcherite policies positively promoted the fragmentation of the common national culture by globalization. Genuinely national institutions, such as the BBC, were attacked relentlessly, while commercial internationalization of the media was actively begun. The nation state was denied any central role, even in the renewal of the national culture. Give me one moment. I need a sip of this drink a second, and I'll put entropy up because we're getting close to super chats here. Stream has gone on a bit longer than I was expecting. The intermediary social institutions on which the free market depended in mid-Victorian England became hindrances to its reconstruction in the late 20th century. Professional associations, local authorities, mutual societies, and stable families were impediments to the mobility and individualism that are acquired by unfettered markets. They limit the power of markets over people. In a late modern context, re-engineering the free market cannot avoid weakening or destroying such intermediary structures, and such was their fate in Britain. It is odd that there are still those who find the... And it's funny, you know, because earlier on, I was watching a... you know, I still have a BBC license by quirk of the fact that it just auto renews every year. And whenever I get a spare moment at home, which are few and far between, I usually sneak onto the From the Archive section. Okay. And there's a documentary on the From the Archive section of the BBC iPlayer on unemployment in Hartlepool in 1963. Okay. So it's a documentary looking at the impact of unemployment in 1963 on this community in Hartlepool, where they'd laid off 3,000 people, okay? And it shows, like, decaying industry and decaying towns and, you know, windows that have been, like, bricked in and stuff like that. One of the things that struck me watching that documentary was the amount of, how can I say, like, social support that those people had in that community, even though they were now unemployed or, you know, going through a rough time. They had all of these intermediary institutions that he's describing here, working men's clubs and so on and so forth, where they were all out for a pint. You know, there was a dude on the piano, or they were having a dance, or, you know, they had places to go and see each other and talk and, you know, times were tough. They were out of work. They'd lost their jobs. And they were having to, like, get, you know, a large part of that documentary was like, what is the impact of this? And they go and talk to the butcher, and they go and talk to the, and the butcher was like, yeah, people are buying cheaper cuts of meat. And they go to the hairdresser, and the hairdresser says, well, you know, when people come in, you know, they quietly ask for, to do their hair pretty short, so that the time between them having to come back is longer, because they've got less money. It's a really fascinating kind of time capsule of what Britain was like in 1963 in this poor area of Hartlepool, where this factory had closed down. Okay, but there was a part of me watching that which thought, actually, do you know what? Those people, even though they were unemployed and they were going through hard times, they didn't know what they had. You watch that documentary and you compare it to people who have jobs today in Britain, let's say a Deliveroo driver or a McDonald's minion, or even somebody who works in the city, right? Even a female graduate who's on like 35K, struggling to get by, or 40K or something, struggling to get by in her marketing job in London. And I reckon lots of those people would watch that documentary of those people who were hard up in 1963 and think, actually, that doesn't look that bad. They at least had a community that they were a part of. They had places that they could go. They had a support network. They were married. At least they had a house, you know. At least they could go and talk to their butcher. They had a butcher, right? I mean, you know, so I had all those sorts of thoughts, and that, you know, if it wasn't BBC, I can't share BBC footage on here because it would be copyrighted, but it's a fascinating document, and I'd love to be able to kind of watch it with everybody and comment on it. But anyway, let us continue. It is odd that there are still those who find the association of free markets with social disorder anomalous. Even if it could itself be rendered stable, the free market is bound to be destructive of other institutions through which social cohesion is preserved. No society can opt for the free market and hope to avoid these consequences. Re-engineering the free market is hardly a conservative political project. Its effect is to sever cultural and institutional continuities, not to renew them. The rights project in present circumstances cannot be the conservation of cultural traditions. It claims to want progress, but progress without any fixed goals. The most clear-sighted and candid of the new rights thinkers defined progress as, quote, movement for movement's sake. I mean, I remember what Thomas Carlyle called it. Nomadism. That's what he called it. Anyway, let's continue. Any genuine conservative must regard this as a prescription for purposeless change. In other words, as an expression of nihilism. In its more concrete uses, which are doubtless the ones that matter to neoliberals, progress, quote unquote, denotes the incessant social change forced on people by the imperatives of free markets. From these necessities arise the insoluble contradictions on which the project founders. The permanent revolution of the free market denies any authority to the past. It nullifies precedent. It snaps the thread of memory and scatters local knowledge. By privileging individual choice over any common good, it tends to make relationships revocable and provisional. In a culture in which choice is the only undisputed value and wants are held to be insatiable, what is the difference between initiating a divorce and trading in a used car? This logic of the free market, which is that all relationships become consumer goods, is denied indignantly by its ideologues. However, it is all too clearly evident in the daily life of societies in which the free market is dominant. If democracy and capitalism work best when they are leavened with cultural traditions that arise from non-liberal sources, then it should be clear, opines Francis Fukuyama blandly, that modernity and tradition can coexist in stable equilibrium for extended periods of time. Of course, as both Karl Marx and Max Weber recognize, modernity and tradition cannot be so smoothly reconciled. In late modern times, globalization works against the traditions it inherits from the early modern age. When a late modern state throws its weights behind the world market, it acts to scatter those inherited traditions to the winds. No amount of Tory social engineering can put together the delicate spider's web of traditions that new technologies and unfettered markets have blown away. It was perhaps predictable that governments dominated by avowed conservatives should have acted in our time as pacemakers for the forced modernization of the society they rule. No less predictable was the inability of neoconservative ideologues to comprehend the dilemma in which societies dominated by the free markets are trapped. That individualist capitalism subverts cultural traditions more successfully than any government is a tribute to the powers of the market and a comment on the limits of state action. It is curious that the same right-wing thinkers who affirm the impotence of states in economic life should have such large hopes of them as social engineers. It is even more incongruous that the new right thinking, much like vulgar Marxism, imagines that economic changes determine behavior, should so systematically disregard the effects of freeing up markets on marriage, the family, and the incidence of crime. The dilemma of the right today is that the cultural conservatism is not among the options open to it. Remember, he's writing in 1998. It is doomed to waver between promoting the free market at any cultural cost and taking up quixotic postures of cultural elitism. It cannot settle in a stable equilibrium any more than the free market can. It oscillates uncertainly between incessantly between unreasonable pessimism about the most recent historical past and wild optimism about the near future. The right today, this is the Tory boys he's talking about, basically. The right today likes to imagine that it is the voice of the past. In truth, its ranting radicalism and its decadent nostalgias tie it to unmistakably and irrevocably to the chaos of the present. The reactionary utopianism of the right is a costly and hazardous venture. Peace and stability are the last things to be expected in societies which allow themselves to be ruled by it. Policies of buttressing traditional forms of family life and repressing the worst symptoms of crime can do little to restore the institutions and communities which the free market has desolated. The fate of the right in the late modern age is to destroy what remains of the past in a vain attempt to recover it. Few visions of the future have ever been so delusive as Herbert Marcuse's or Michel Foucault's perennially fashionable vision of perfected capitalist control of society. Late modern capitalism may incarcerate people in high-tech prisons and monitor them by video surveillance cameras at their workplace and in the high street, but it does not box them into an iron cage of bureaucracy or imprison them forever within a minute niche in the division of labor. It abandons them to the life of fragments and a proliferation of senseless choices. The dystopia we face is not a nightmare of totalitarian control, intermingling the ephemera of fashion with an ingrained reflex of nihilism. American Psycho is a truer approximation to the late modern condition than Kafka's The Castle. Free markets are the most potent solvents of tradition at work in the world today. They set a premium on novelty and a discount on the past. They make of the future an infinite rerun of the present. The society they engender is antinomian and proletarian. The society they engender is antinomian and proletarian. Free markets are often attacked for their short-term approach investment to industry. But the free market is most recklessly short-termist in its demolition of the virtues that it once relied upon. These virtues, saving, civic pride, respectability, quote-unquote family values, are now profitless museum pieces. They are bits of bric-a-brac, dusted off for public display from time to time by the right-wing media, but having few uses in an economy founded on ephemera. The most enduring icon of the free market in the late 20th century will not be Margaret Thatcher. It may well turn out to be Madonna. And that's the end of the excerpt I wanted to read for you. Thought it was very interesting indeed from John Gray. Very interesting. I would just say this went on longer due to the interventions of low IQ members of chat, which wasted time at the start of the stream. I'm not going to be able to read the other bits I had planned for this stream, but if you want to find them yourself, I have them in a book called Gray's Anatomy, but he has two follow-up essays on this. One is called The Strange Death of Tory England, which is on page 161. You can probably find it online, I'd imagine. The Strange Death of Tory England. And the other one is called Margaret Thatcher and the Euthanasia of Conservatism, which is on page 182 of that same volume, where he basically elaborates on some of these same themes. But you get the idea, and I think it's a kind of powerful, powerful critique of what has happened and Thatcher's role in what has happened. I find myself, to be honest, largely convinced by this analysis. I understand that to some extent what Thatcher did was necessary, because things were bad in the 70s, right, economically speaking. But the cost, what were the costs of what she did? One of the most blackpilling parts of that analysis is the fact that it's so irreversible, can't ever get it back, it's lost forever. And to the extent where most of the people watching this show, including me, never got to experience the social bonds that he is talking about. So, anyway, I think it's valuable to consider this analysis. I don't say it's the final word on the matter, but I think it's important. In some ways, it's responding, or it's an entry into an ongoing debate between different parts of the right at the moment. I did listen to Bronze Age Pervert's latest podcast, which was very interesting in itself, where he was kind of championing the chap in Argentina, Milei, and having a go at kind of neo-Marxist critiques coming from Christian right in America. I find myself more convinced by this analysis by John Gray than some of the arguments that Bat put forward in the first part of that show. What else? Let me have a look at some super chats before we get out of here. So there's just been a couple. WC Schmuck says, how was your 24-hour Twitter vacation? Yeah, good. I mean, pretty easy, to be honest. I mean, I'm not, it's not that hard not to tweet, you know. I don't know. I saw one too many things that got to me on Twitter, and I was like, I'm going to have to take a detox for a day. Ian Inkster says, Boomer left. World went off at a tangent with Thatcher, and the mission is to get it back on the old timeline. Boomer right, the wrong term was Blairism. Yes, indeed. I would say that something else has gone wrong entirely. Mo Tuil says, why shouldn't people have to pay UC payments back? What are UC payments? The latest BAP show, Benjamin Rood, the latest one, whatever the latest one was. I mean, it was a good show. There's lots of interesting stuff in there, as always, but I am not convinced by his low-key defense of neoliberalism. I cannot overlook some of the things that John Gray was talking about there, and the fact that the dissolving acid of social bonds and traditions coincides with market liberalization, which cannot be overlooked. BAP's argument is, why do you want to try to save those? Why do you want to save those things? You know, I mean, to be honest, the point is kind of moot, because John Gray is correct that those things aren't going to be, you can't like use the central government to revive them. Like, you can't like artificially engineer high trust through the blunt weapon of Westminster. Because, as he correctly pointed out in his analysis, many of those institutions that he's talking about are local and as he was putting it, intermediary, i.e. they weren't controlled by the central government. They weren't centralized. They were decentralized. It's Putnam again. It's Bowling Alone as well, which I mentioned at the start of the stream. Almost none of the things in Bowling Alone were controlled by the federal government or indeed the local government. They weren't functioning the government at all. But they are things that have been destroyed by a market economy, nonetheless. Supreme Magus 88 says, Sir Joseph was the architect of Thatcherism. So who's Sir Joseph? Who's that then? Unfortunately, I've lost my mouse, and I'm not going to be able to end the stream until I get my mouse, which has gone behind my desk. What a pain. So listen to some light music or something while I retrieve my mouse. And then I'm going to go and see if Millennial is on and watch that. Hold on. Right. What a pain. Oh, now the battery's gone on the bloody mouse. Now we're stuck until my computer recognizes my mouse again. Okay. Bloody hell. I had to unplug my mouse to get it to reconnect somehow. And then I accidentally unplugged my mic as well. So that's what happened there. Just a couple more entropies before we go. Sam153 says, AA, you need to destroy Reaganism next. Well, there's plenty on Reaganism by John Gray. So maybe I will do that. The Henry Ab says, good stream, AA. Did you ever watch Adam Curtis's first series, Pandora's Box? It covers a lot of the changes in the 1970s and the 1980s. Boom bust economics and the rise of asset strippers like James Goldsmith. There's a reason people of a certain age will always vote Labour due to the destruction of these communities. Yeah, I did. I've watched all of Adam Curtis's stuff, apart from his latest move. I didn't watch his last one. I still have that yet to do. There we go. And I think, is that it? I've now, for some reason, going out of the stream and coming back in has affected my ability to see the other super chats now. Oh, well, if anybody else has sent any, I will have to pick them up. Did anybody else send any? Sorry, guys. Okay. Thank you very much to everybody. I may well do an Adam Curtis thing soon, because I've always liked him. This was not a cigar stream, rude. There will be one tomorrow where I'll be continuing to go through Britain's blunder. And just remind everybody, 25% off all courses, Vax Glide 2. And all that's left for me to say is get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.